Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Marnie Eisenstadt. She's a public affairs reporter for the Syracuse Post-Standard and has been writing about different aspects of the local fight against COVID and its economic effects, including employment issues and stimulus spending. Marnie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. Let me just start with this question. You recently wrote a story about Onondaga County being the first upstate county to mandate that everyone working in a school either be vaccinated or tested weekly for COVID. And I was just curious, how's that requirement been received? Because there's so much controversy across the country about these things. How's that been received here or in the state?
So locally, it really has been well received. I think part of why that is that Ryan McMahon had union leaders from the different schools in the conversation before he announced this change, before we knew about this. So they were not surprised by this. And I think the other thing, at least in speaking with the head of the North Syracuse Teachers Union, which is the second largest union in the county, he said that because the mandate still allows people to not be vaccinated, they felt like that was fair. He also said that more than 80% of the union representatives had already been vaccinated, and that was a week and a half ago. So
Has there been, do you know whether there's been any notice of this mandate being taken by other upstate counties or even some of the downstate counties outside of New York City? Are people paying attention to us?
So I have not heard of that, but I think there's just been so much noise. And I think there a lot of people have also been trying to put off decisions until Hochul was sworn into office. Many organizations that are advising, especially superintendents, were saying, you know, this sort of switches to the mask mandate, but they were saying, just wait, because she's going to have something to do with this. And of course she did. But to my knowledge, no others have taken that up. I think there has been some indication that that is something that she is looking at.
Well, that's actually leads right into the next thing I wanted to ask you about, which was mask wearing. And my understanding is that there's still some variation in the Syracuse area regarding the upcoming rules. So where do things stand right now?
So, right now the state has mandated what the county recommended.
Okay.
So I don't think there is any room for that variation to exist. But, you know, I think also anyone who wants to can file, you know, can file a court action. I mean, we haven't seen that yet, but, you know, I might anticipate that.
So right now, though, everyone is wearing masks.
Right now, all schools are requiring everyone who steps inside to wear masks. I think, you know, if you have some medical necessity or other disability and you have a note from a healthcare provider,
okay,
you might not have to do that. But, you know, I know my two kids are going back to school and they are fully prepared to wear masks. We have a million different colors and black, many black.
So I imagine that in the course of your reporting, you've certainly talked to a lot of different people and you've gotten a sense of what's going on the ground. Going back to the vaccine, and I've been asking all sorts of different people, different versions of this question for the last 6 months, but do you have any sense of, in this area, what's motivating people not to get a vaccine? Are there some things you're hearing more often than others? What's your sense?
So, you know, I think some of it is what is motivating people nationally. I think there are some people who are very good at using Facebook for misinformation that looks a lot like science, and that is definitely floating around. I think they're also, and this is something I heard from, you know, people who are friends of mine, in the beginning of this summer, there has been this really prevalent misconception that something within the vaccine will alter DNA and affect fertility. And that's just not true. There are entire articles that clearly explain why this is not true, but I think that we are in an age of so much information, and parents sometimes feel really overwhelmed. And when someone tells you loudly, you're gonna screw up your kid if you do this, I think a lot of people, you know, in June when it extended to 12-year-olds, I think a lot of people sort of really had to muddle through that. So friends of mine who asked me about it, I said, I am vaccinating my child and I can explain to you why I think it's safe, and I can share with you these articles, you know, by people smarter than me, talking to experts that explain that.
Well, let me shift gears here and ask you a question about the business climate, because you've written a lot on the business climate from different perspectives. What's your sense of the impact of COVID on local businesses, if it's possible, just to give an overall assessment there?
You know, I think it largely depends on what sector of business we're talking about. Restaurants and hospitality businesses have really been pummeled, and that's the same nationwide. And I think a lot of them are now talking about changing their business models, especially the restaurant industry. I think other businesses have been more able to come back. The business I work for, you know, things were really rough for a while, and it's much better now. I have not written about the different stimulus money that programs that have gone to businesses. My colleagues have done a wonderful job examining that. I think some people were better able to get that money than others, and that rollout did impact them.
You've done some pieces on the behavior of local workers during all this. Do you have a sense of the impact on them as opposed to the businesses?
No, I think there are workers who were working low wage, people facing jobs at the beginning of the pandemic, really took a lot of risk and were not often treated well for the risk that, by the public and sometimes by their employers, for the risk that they were taking. And I think that many of them, for months have been examining, how to go back or whether to go back. And people both here and across the country are making choices about changing trajectory with their careers. So there's a lot of data that shows that. And that makes that's something that happens in every recession, but this has been more of a bomb than a recession. And so I think that impact will be greater.
That's interesting, it being sort of an inflection point for a lot of individuals and thinking about their careers. You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Marnie Eisenstadt. She's a public affairs reporter for the Syracuse Post-Standard. Well, there was a recent story of yours really that focused in on one particular aspect of all this, which is that some workers are apparently loath to return to work because of the unemployment benefits and have refused to retake their jobs or take other jobs. And this has frustrated some employers so much that they're reporting them to the state because they can't get people to work for them. That's one of the challenges that the businesses have been facing. So do you think that the state and the federal government have been perhaps too generous in these benefits or too lax about enforcing the rules that if you refuse work, you don't get them?
I think I can see, I want to be careful what I say here. I think I can see both sides of the frustration. I think if I am a worker who prior to the pandemic was making minimum wage, was just less than $13 an hour, and then suddenly, and that is hard to live off of. That is very hard to live off of, and it is hard to feed a family off of. And then suddenly I can make more than that through unemployment, you know, that creates a series of decisions. And it's hard to fault someone for wanting to make more money to be better set. And also I think we forget that even now with the Delta variant, people are taking a risk. People are taking a risk. And some of what that additional unemployment money did was it has a little bit blown apart a sort of caste system that we had quietly set up in this country. Like, we just expect people to come back to these low wage jobs. And, but I also see it from the employer's perspective. They are offering more money and more money and, signing bonuses to wash dishes, which is just unheard of. And people are not coming back to those jobs. And that's so hard on their businesses that they have built. So I can understand why they're like, oh, I'm reporting this. But I mean, the state has been unable to even get checks out to all the people who are, still waiting for the checks. So to expect some kind of enforcement from them when they are just still underwater, I think that's just, that has not been happening.
Yeah, there's an industrial place that I drive by in Oneida frequently, and they have a sign up looking for workers, and they've posted the starting wage, and I've noticed that the number has changed several times. And it's higher now than it was before. And it got me thinking, and your piece got me thinking of this too, that even though there was a lot of discussion that this might happen prior to the stimulus package, I still get the sense that business owners are kind of surprised that they're having to go to these lengths.
I think some of them are, because I think prior to this, it had never been that hard to get workers. But I think, there are threads of this that we don't see that go beyond that narrative of just people don't want to work. And it's, some people have been working two jobs, right? That's, or three jobs. Like, a lot of people who work in restaurants, that's their second job. And they're missing, one of the people who was in the early stories I did, like, she was missing time with her kid and, working a job. So when she was able to get some additional unemployment, she was able to spend extra time with her child. And that made her think, well, is this, do I really want to go back to that? Or do I want to find something else? But I think the other thing that will be interesting to see is what happens to wages when that money goes away. I don't think that, and what is the true, people are talking about inflation, but, what will the true impact be? It'll be interesting to see. I have no idea.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Marnie Eisenstadt. She's a public affairs reporter for the Syracuse Post-Standard, and we've been discussing different aspects of the local response to COVID. So, sticking on this topic of workers and employers, I understand that you've also been looking at some new research on the effects of the termination of these enhanced benefits for workers, and whether that's going to boost the number of available and willing workers. What do you think you're finding there so far?
So it seems like there were two pretty significant studies done by, technology companies that, it's kind of funny, they're technology companies that provide time clock technology for roughly 4 million employees. So, and most of them are lower wage workers. And so those two companies were able to analyze what happened in the states. There are 26 states where the governors said no thank you to the federal government. We don't want your additional pandemic unemployment benefits anymore because we want people to come back to work. So they were able to look at how that impacted employment in those sectors in the 26 states that cut it versus those that kept it. And it did not have the impact on growth that people expected. It didn't. It was not like flipping a switch that sent people back to work. And economists and even some employers here are saying now that they also do not think that is what will happen when these benefits expire in New York on September 6th. The economists that I've talked to have said, you know, that's because this is not just about money. It's just not. It's about childcare, which the pandemic laid bare the problem of that. It's about safety. It's about risk. And people really have had a chance to say, is this really what I want to be doing with my life? You know, they watched thousands and thousands of people die also. That mm-hmm. makes human beings examine what they're doing with their lives. So some of it is an emotional analysis.
And on the wage side of it, before the break, you were wondering, you know, what will happen with wages when the benefits expire. Do you think that there are any sectors that where you might see a permanent raise in the wages for the entry-level positions? This could be like a whole restructuring of that part of the economy?
I do. I don't think that places where they raised wages that they will be able to knock them back down. I think it's really hard to put that horse back in the barn. Mm-hmm. So I think wages will stay high. I think a lot of places also, they raised wages some, but some also added in softer things that are easier to remove, like hiring bonuses and benefits. Some places started offering tremendous benefits. So, and those are easier to cut. So it'll be interesting to see whether all of those incentives also stay on or whether they fall away.
Well, shifting gears now, I want to think about how some of this stimulus money is being spent that's going to different government entities. And I've spoken to the Syracuse mayor about how the city plans to spend its share of the federal stimulus money, but school districts themselves also are getting chunks of money. And so you've looked a little bit at that, in my understanding, and written some things about that. So first of all, I just want to check something with you that my understanding is the Syracuse School District is getting more money relative to most other districts. And that's due to its high level of need as defined by poverty. Do I have that basically correct?
That's correct. So of the, in New York State, all of the, I think we call them the Big Six, some people call them the Big Five, but all of these city school districts are getting a much higher percentage of this money. And that's because they use a formula that already exists that measures districts' need. And depending on which measures you look at, an inordinately high percentage of kids who go to school in the city school district live in poverty. And so Syracuse is getting more than the city school district is getting more than $100 million of stimulus money, and the suburban districts, I mean, I don't have the list in front of me, but they're in the single, maybe there's one or two that make it into the double digits. But I mean, it's also because the city school district serves 20,000 kids. The next highest district serves 9,000.
Right.
So it's a whole city of children.
But $100 million is a significant chunk compared to their entire budget. So I guess
it's like a quarter of their budget.
Yeah. So are you seeing any overall patterns in how the administrators are saying that money is going to be spent and any noticeable differences between the city and the suburbs and where they intend to put the money?
You know, I don't know as I, unfortunately, I don't know as much about the suburbs and how they are spending that money, but the city is came out with, a sort of broad plan about how they were going to spend the money. And a significant portion of it is going to be aimed at improving services for mental health for kids in the school district, more counselors, other kinds of wraparound services. Which I think I'm a parent, and I just think that the pandemic has been tremendously hard on children, which is something I wrote about, I think in March, but we will see the ripples of the fallout of this for a long time. And many kids in the city were already struggling with, you see the rate of violence in some places in the city, there's a lot of trauma. So they are spending a lot of money on that. They have to spend a certain portion of it on something on improving. I can't remember exactly how it's phrased, but it has to, they have to spend some of it on learning and improving specific educational things. And so they used some of that money for already, I think I have this right, for summer school programs this summer that were available to all kids. And it sounds like that's something that might continue.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Marnie Eisenstadt, a reporter for the Syracuse Post-Standard. So we've got a few minutes left. I want to ask one more question about this and then shift to a bigger topic. But you mentioned that a lot of the money going to mental health. And so whether it's going to mental health or whether it's going to learning or however we want to describe that more narrow function, do you have any sense of whether this money is going to be spent to build permanent infrastructure and changes or whether it's more like we're going to try to Band-Aid what has happened in the immediate effects of COVID on our students' mental health and their abilities to learn?
So, that's a great question. And I'm not sure I have the answer. I think, there was some, it's interesting when someone hands you a present and it creates concern, but that is what happens here because people say, well, this money only lasts for a certain amount of time. Like has to be spent at the end of 3 years, the majority of it. So that means you can fund a counselor for 3 years. What do you do after that? So I think there's been some, calculation that's going on to try and keep, keep them from, creating something great and then having to cut it. Some of it, the money also is going to be spent on improving ventilation systems. And I think even some of the windows, they can use it for upgrading some parts of the physical plant. So that stuff will continue, but that is a great question. But this is really, for forever, the city has been begging for money and that, that's not fair. And that's what all city school districts have been saying. And this is like a giant pot of gold. And I think there's a lot of, people are really trying to spend it the right way.
Yeah, it creates.
And we'll continue to pay attention.
Good. It definitely creates, I can see how it creates stress. So we've got just about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I wanted to get into a different topic that you've written about in the past, but it relates to all of this that we've been talking about. And that's the high levels of concentrated poverty and overall economic inequality in the city of Syracuse, and also comparing the city to the suburbs too. So I'm just wondering, do you think COVID's going to have a dent on that? Is it going to move Syracuse out of like the list of the 10 worst cities when it comes to some of these measures, do you think?
That's a good question, and it'll be interesting to see. I think unfortunately the people who were more significantly impacted by COVID are people, in communities of poverty. They, are people who, are Black and Brown communities. And so they are bearing in many places, and including here, they're bearing a larger share of this burden. But it will be interesting to see if, you know, the stimulus payments, the child tax credit money, and you know, other things that arose, not just because of COVID, whether or not that helps people create a cushion. And I think too, there are problems that were really laid bare by COVID, like just the childcare problems that, you know, moms and dads have all been talking to each other about for decades, but in low wage jobs, it is a tremendous problem. And hopefully more attention will be paid to that now.
And we have just about a minute. I wanted to squeeze this last question in. And it seems to me that Syracuse may be in line in the coming years for kind of a double good whammy of money. The first is the one that you and I have been discussing. The second one is that there's going to be a massive amount of federal spending regarding the tearing down and replacement of I-81, and then a major redevelopment of the on-the-ground footprint of I-81 in the East Adams Street area. In just a few seconds, do you think that, on top of what you were just describing, might also put a dent in the city's problem of inequality?
You know, I am an optimistic person, so I will say yes. But I think that also, you know, the community has to pay attention, has to advocate for the, you know, for jobs for the right people, and you know, and I hope to be writing some about that in the future. But I think it can. I think it also, though, anything of that scale is also going to be really uncomfortable. So it is important for all of us to look beyond the noise of that and make sure that the communities that were so disaffected before, so hurt before, are being treated the right way.
Yeah, that's a big concern. And we'll look forward to seeing those articles in the future. But for now, that was Marnie Eisenstadt. Marnie, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks. It was great fun.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, conversations in the public interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher and edited by Mark LeVellier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/campbellconversations.